KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories, and segues may or may not be jarring, but the stories are interesting. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
First thing, there are no elections coming up right now, but we are coming up to the November 2nd general election. So it is worth noting that October 4th, which is just about 2 weeks away, is your last day that you can register and be eligible to vote on November 2nd. So, as I will always encourage you, you can go to votetexas.gov and check your registration status. If you're not registered, you can get instructions for registering. I will say that it can be a little tricky because I was on that site today. I was curious to see if, you know, I'm steering people right. And it's a little tricky there to get like your sample ballot if you don't know how to navigate it. My suggestion is try to go to your county election clerk. And we have links on every show blog post to all the adjacent Harris County and all the adjacent clerks. So votetexas.gov or try to get to your local election clerk. And remember, you have until October 4th to register, or you will not be able to vote in this election if you are a new registrant. Okay, next, kind of a PSA. Do you own an iPhone or an iPad? There's an emergency patch for your Apple device right now. Apparently, there is an exploit that doesn't require you to do anything wrong, but it can still intrude on your phone. So Apple learned about this, I guess it was several months ago, I think we talked about it, Andrew?
Yes, something like that.
And it's this Israeli spy firm, and they're supposedly leasing software to governments, except the governments are using it to spy on, like, protesters and stuff, journalists. So once Apple learned about that, they have been working on a patch for that. And they came up with one, I think it was yesterday or the day before. So if you have not done an update on your phone, I strongly encourage you to do an update on your phone. The instructions are simple, so I am going to read them. You go and, I mean, you can look this up online, but I'm just going to read them because they're short. Go to settings. Go to general and tap that. And then go to software update and tap that. Try to do this with Wi-Fi access so you're not doing it over your phone network. When you're ready, plug in your device. They suggest making sure you have at least 50% battery life. I would not cut it that close. Just try to be in a place where you can plug in your device and then tap install now. And your computer will do its update thing because your phone is your computer. And I'm looking at a computer, so I'm getting confused. Okay, so that's our public service announcement. Next story from communityimpact.com. Decorative mental health resources now installed throughout Sugarland. I thought this was interesting. At a September 7th city council meeting, the city of Sugarland presented six unique wooden information boxes containing information on free mental health resources that will be placed throughout the city on September 10th. This project came about in response to two community needs, said Suzanne Gray, the city's cultural arts manager, at a June meeting discussing the call for artists for the program. She went on, COVID-19 not only affected businesses' bottom lines, but many people's mental health. Nationally, suicide completion rates have surged to a 30-year high. Grant funding from Fort Bend County became available, and the city saw an opportunity to pair support for our businesses, the creative sector, and mental health through this project. That isn't actually pairing. That's actually triparting, but never mind. The project was executed through a partnership with a nonprofit movement dedicated to presenting hope and finding help for people struggling with depression, addiction, self-injury, and suicidal thoughts. The boxes, which feature uplifting designs such as flowers and frogs. When did frogs become uplifting? Is it a Kermit thing?
Frogs are friends.
They will be placed, these boxes, throughout the city, located next to positive messages embellishing the sidewalks. They were each designed, each of these boxes, and created by local artists. It's a unique approach, Gray says, but one that fits in with local with Sugar Land residents' expressed interest in public art to beautify the city. This project enables us to provide that while also making mental health materials readily available to everyone. I think this is a really interesting initiative. And, you know, something that you're not so likely to find if you're not looking at, like, a community paper. I don't know if it would be in the Chronicle. Maybe not, but cool.
So I agree. It's a very interesting idea, especially from the idea of creating an opportunity for public art installations, these sorts of things. But from the mental health side, it's a stopgap. It's better to have it than not to have it, of course. But the only way to end mental illness, which I think is the end goal, is to end the circumstances, be they personal or societal, that cause it.
Well, you're assuming that it's not biological, neurochemical. You're assuming that society is the cause and not the effect.
That's true. But I think
there's both. I think it's a matter of nature and it's a matter of nurture. And there are some people that are born with depressive or bipolar tendencies or whatever the different psychological problem might be. And there are some people that have it induced. And then there are people that have it induced because they have the tendency toward it. So
I think that's fair in that, you know, there may be neurochemical causes of different mental illnesses. But I think that, you know, social and personal issues exacerbate them into being a bigger thing than they perhaps otherwise would be.
Well, perhaps, perhaps not. I think, perhaps, though, the point of this is that it's an inducement to seek help if you feel you might need it. It reminds you help is available. And if you don't have insurance that covers that kind of help, the city is prepared to provide it for free. And I think those are the bullet points. Those are the takeaways from this story that matter.
Absolutely.
Okay, next from communityimpact.com, many Fort Bend County flood bond projects, including those in the Sugar Land and Missouri City areas, are left unfunded. 4 years after Hurricane Harvey, 10 of 25 drainage efforts from Fort Bend County's 2019 flood bond are unfunded or on pause. However, 5 of the 6 projects affecting the Sugar Land and Missouri City areas are moving forward. Fort Bend County voters approved the county's $83 million flood bond in November 2019, 2 years after Harvey devastated the area in August of 2017. Mark Vogler, the Fort Bend County Drainage District General Manager and Chief Engineer, said most of the paused projects are due to a lack of supplemental funding. He described the county's bids for grants to use with bond money as, quote, wishful thinking. Despite the delays, some of the bond work is being done in Missouri City through cooperation with city officials. Both Missouri City and Sugar Land officials said they are working on their own drainage mitigation projects. Flood mitigation or drainage mitigation? I don't know if you want to mitigate drainage, but anyway, I'm being picky or pedantic. One stalled project affecting the Sugar Land and Missouri City area is a $6.25 million flooding mitigation, structure at Flat Bank Creek, which was delayed due to a lack of funding. That structure would have aimed to prevent floodwaters from backing up. While Flatbank Creek's flood structure project is stalled, its $2.5 million erosion repair project secured the funding it needed and is moving forward with the bid process. Fort Bend County Drainage District officials said they're working with FEMA to repair erosion damage and sloughing. The banks are starting to slough, said Vogler, which means they're starting to slide off and just fall in. If the bank falls in, the levee at the top is going to have a tendency to fall in or lose stability. I would also add that if the bank sloughs in, it also fills to some extent the detention pond or detention area, which reduces its capacity. Additionally, Vogler said the county applied for $96 million in funding from the Texas General Land Office in 2020, but learned in May it did not receive any. Hard to believe, but maybe Sugar Land isn't Republican enough? Anyway, moreover, the channel repair, erosion repair, and desilting projects were meant to restore the damage done by Hurricane Harvey, not mitigate future damage, Vogler said. While many projects were not able to secure the funding needed to move forward, others were fully funded by the bond or secured funding elsewhere, such as FEMA or the Natural Resources Conservation Service. While the county continues to work toward securing funding for additional projects, both Missouri City and Sugar Land are working independently to improve their preparation for another major flooding event. And while city and county officials are working to make improvements to mitigate flooding, Texas residents, this is important, folks, Texas residents who insure their properties through the National Flood Insurance Program will soon be subject to a cost increase. FEMA said in April it will be implementing a new methodology to determine a property's flood risk, dubbed Risk-Taking 2.0. The change will go into effect October 1st. Increased flood insurance rates for 70, now this is not the amount of the increase, but rates will increase for 77% of policyholders, FEMA estimated. Risk rating 2.0 will go into effect October 1st for new flood insurance policyholders and April 1st for renewed policies. There is a point to be made here, and this is always the case, whether it's for rate increases or not. Flood insurance doesn't go into effect, I should say, for 30 days. So if you were to sign up for flood insurance now, you wouldn't get it until essentially this date in October. So you can't, like, hear of a hurricane coming, sign up for flood insurance and expect to be covered. They want you to assume that you're not in danger of flooding before you get insured for flooding, which in its way makes sense. Andrew?
Yes. I mean, it's easy to say that the Texas GLO should be less stingy, especially where genuine public safety is concerned. But would that be enough to solve the funding problem? Not necessarily. I wonder if Fort Bend understated the cash necessary for the projects in order to make the bond more likely to pass.
It seemed like the bond was a little small to me, but, you know, I don't know what their revenue situation is. Mm. But, you know, I do say frequently, you get the government you pay for. You know, yeah. People want low taxes, but full services. And, you know, there's a saying that I came up with a number of years ago that government constantly wants you to do more with less. At some point, that means they're expecting you to do everything with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not feasible. Okay, from the Texas Tribune, a Texas school district doesn't require masks. The state is suing the district anyway. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has sued 9 more school districts over their masking rules. One says it doesn't mandate them. Another says it doesn't enforce mask wearing at Paxton's request. The Midway Independent School District is a Waco area district that sits on a list compiled by the Attorney General's Office of school districts and counties that have flouted Governor Greg Abbott's ban and put in place their own mask wearing orders. The hitch? Midway ISD doesn't mandate that students or teachers or school staff or visitors don masks while on school premises, a district spokesperson said. Midway officials have tried to convince the Attorney General's office the district doesn't have a mandate, but to no avail. Under Midway's virus protocol, campuses can issue a 10-day mask directives that encourage mask wearing on the premises if virus transmission reaches a certain level, but doesn't require it. the Attorney General's office pointed to that protocol as the basis of its lawsuit against the district, but declined to answer other questions from the Texas Tribune. McGregor ISD, another district near Waco, did require mask wearing if virus transmission became too severe, but at Paxton's request did not enforce the mandate, Superintendent James Lenneman said in a statement. Nonetheless, Paxton sued the district. Paxton announced lawsuits against seven other districts on Tuesday. Last week, Paxton sued six districts, the first time he had done so since the dispute between the state's Republican leadership and local officials began in August, And this is the line that I love. This should be engraved on his tombstone. Not that I'm wishing anything to hurry it up. Paxton's office wrote in a tweet Tuesday afternoon, quote, "There will be more to come as lawlessness continues across the state." Lawlessness. Wearing masks is lawless. Just, I want you to keep this in mind. Lawlessness, mask wearing. Paris ISD officials had taken the novel approach of requiring students to wear masks as part of the dress code, with the district's general counsel credited with keeping absence, which the district's general counsel credited with keeping absences related to COVID-19 low. The general counsel said, quote, "Thank goodness we have the Attorney General to come to our rescue." Speaking of which, from the Texas Tribune, over 6,000 Texans have died of COVID-19 in the last month, putting the overall toll to more than 59,000. The Texas Tribune is using daily data from the Texas Department of State Health Services to track coronavirus vaccinations, cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. The state data comes from vaccine providers, city and county health departments, hospitals, and labs. It may not represent all cases of the disease given limited testing. Sarcasm alert. So here again, we have examples of two enduring philosophies, maybe not sarcasm, of the modern Republican Party. A, local control is about freedom until we can overrule your local control. And B, Republicans are allegedly pro-life until you're born, but then they want to kill you. And of course, you have to love Ken Paxton's tirade about lawlessness continuing across the state. Lawlessness. The lawlessness Paxton describes as school districts trying their reasonable best to protect the lives and health of children, educators, parents, and more. Maybe it's time we create what we call breathe-easies in schools. A lookout signals when everyone has to take off their masks, when the state's C-men or COVID men come poking around. When these guys leave, the breathe-easies reopen and masks go back up. It will be all very prohibition-y. If protecting public health, according to science, is lawlessness, I say let's have more of it. Because Ken Paxton and Greg Abbott obviously don't recognize a battle against tyranny when they see it. Andrew?
I feel compelled to point out that Mike said C as in the letter C.
Yes.
Yes. For COVID. Well, it's good to see you coming around to my way of thinking on lawlessness. I mean, I'm very much pro-lawlessness. I love lawlessness. Yeah, let's get more lawlessness. In seriousness, this is further proof that Republican governance is more like a wild rampage. Let's sue all the schools in Texas, even if they're complying with our ridiculous demands. What a joke.
It's basically fascist governance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like, I think Michigan was sort of the textbook case of Republican tyranny with their emergency manager laws. And we saw what that did in Flint, Michigan. So. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2. We air Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org. From anywhere in the world, you can podcast it on your phone's podcast app, something I suggest, or you can go to archive.kpft.org, where you can listen to past broadcasts of this show and any of the other 100 or so shows that KPFT broadcasts. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more at the top of the page. find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar, which I do all the time. We're also on social media where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig and look for me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio because I have no imagination and Andrew has his own accounts, maybe with more imagination.
I wouldn't say more imagination. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and on Tumblr spelled the same at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay, our next story, and this is one that was brought to my attention by Andrew, is from Native News Online. Petitions filed to have the U.S. Supreme Court decide on Indian Child Welfare Act constitutionality. The state of Texas, four tribes, and several parents have filed petitions asking the Supreme Court to review the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA. The petitions stem from U.S. Fifth Court of Appeals decision last April in the Brackeen versus Halland, originally Brackeen versus Bernhardt, that originally alleged the ICWA is unconstitutional for discriminating against non-Native families in the placement of Native children. Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978 in response to Native children being removed from their homes and placed with non-Native families. Research by the National Indian Child Welfare Association found that between 25 and 35% of all Native children were forcibly removed from their home by state child welfare and private adoption agencies. Of them, of these children, 85% were placed with non-Native families, even when fit and willing relatives were available. ICWA is a safeguard aimed at preventing such a crisis from occurring by enabling tribes and families to be involved in child welfare cases. The National Congress of American Indians on Monday released the following statement, quote, on September 3rd, 2021, the U.S., tribal defendants, and state and private plaintiffs filed petitions asking the United States Supreme Court to review the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision, a case challenging the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. The Protect ICWA campaign stands with the United States, which is defending the act, and tribal defendants who have defended ICWA and its critical protections for Indian children and families who are in state court child custody proceedings. ICWA represents the gold standard in child welfare practice and has helped tens of thousands of Indian children and families find fairness and healing in state child welfare systems for over 40 years. So my first thought, sadly, is that whatever side the state of Texas is on is probably the wrong side. I hate feeling that way, but that's the way I feel. But my second thought relates to the first sentence in the story, that the state of Texas, four tribes, and several parents have filed petitions. Now, to me, the key phrase is four tribes and several parents. Now, I assume that these groups are included in the action to give the state standing to bring the action. They have to have plaintiffs. I would feel better, and I mean, I'm not disputing any of the facts or details in the story. Mm-hmm. But I would feel better about the story if it discussed the grounds being claimed by the parents and the tribes listed as plaintiffs, because that's obviously what Texas is using in order to bring this case. Part of the story isn't being reported. I don't want to say that's suspicious, but it certainly is incomplete reporting. In the context of the Canadian Indigenous school scandal, I think this story deserves more detailed discussion by the writers and not less. Andrew?
Well, I agree with you that aspects of this story still need coverage, but specifically the grounds that the tribes and parents are arguing against the act are bringing forward. Because if nothing else, it will help the people trying to defend the act to sort of understand where they're coming from and maybe make effective arguments why it's not a problem. However, I still think the best position to take right now is against Texas and for the act. Suspending the act would make it easier for states to take Native children from their parents, something that historically resulted in placing them with non-Native families, as the article mentions, who don't respect the child's origins. This weakens Native cultures by reducing the amount of people taking part in them, and especially when considered alongside the recent abortion ban in Texas, not technically a ban, but might as well
effectively
can be used to try and get more kids adopted by conservative families to increase conservatives' voting base. the possibility of all these things, I think, is enough to support the ICWA right now.
Well, I mean, on the surface, of course, these days, anything that the Texas Republican-dominated government favors is probably safe to oppose.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a little surprised, not unhappy necessarily, that your initial part of your statement basically said that the plaintiffs may actually have grounds.
Sure.
Standing.
Sure.
I mean, we don't know what those grounds are. In the case of the families, it might be legitimate affection for children that are being taken from them because they're non-native. In the case of the tribes, I can't speak to that, except maybe it's a legitimate difference of opinion, or maybe, and I'm not saying this is the case, but speculatively, maybe the Texas government gave them some kind of a concession. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Who knows? We're in Texas.
We are in Texas.
So anyway, I think that this is a case that I would like to have followed up.
Yes.
Maybe sometime down the road, I would like to know how this proceeds.
Something to watch, absolutely.
Definitely. Watch this space, as some people say. Texas Tribune. Texas foster care children exposed to sexual abuse, given wrong medication, and neglected in unlicensed placements, new report says. The federal judge overseeing the decade-long lawsuit against Texas for conditions in its foster care system cut this week's hearing short, the judge did. She proposed all parties involved, including the governor, cut to the chase, her words, to identify solutions. U.S. District Judge Janice Jack made her suggestion of the novel approach after Paul Yetter, lead attorney representing children, asked if the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services would be willing to sit down with his team and other state agencies to discuss potential solutions. Jack said that before she moves forward, she wants the governor's sign off and support for the plan. Tuesday's hearing began before the release of the court monitor's latest report, which detailed disturbing conditions that children in state custody endured this year after being placed in unlicensed facilities. Children in unlicensed placements were at times given the wrong medications, while others went without their prescribed medication for days, according to the report. Investigators found evidence of child-on-child sexual abuse. Some children ran away, and there's evidence that some communicated with sex traffickers. Untrained staff members restrained children as young as 7, and in one placement, a security guard handcuffed a child. The monitors also discovered that children with serious emotional disorders harmed themselves while in state custody, and some of them did not receive treatment. There's evidence that children cut themselves with sharp objects, attempted to hang themselves to the point of losing consciousness, and ingested cleaning fluids. Unlicensed placements have continued to balloon in Texas since last year. During the first half of 2021, 501 children spent at least one night in a non-licensed state-operated placement, the report said. On average, children spent 2 weeks consecutively in unlicensed placements, with one child spending 144 consecutive nights in such placements.
Jesus.
The story has much more discussion of the failures of the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services than what I have excerpted here. I think the point of the story is that the legal struggle over the horrible experiences that children in Texas foster care have experienced for at least a decade. To some extent, this is another example of getting the government you pay for. That is, maybe more resources would help. But I get a sense that these kids are given the same consideration given to Texas prisoners. We've had the discussion of whether convicts are sent to prison as punishment or sent to prison for punishment. This is a different story. If innocent children are submitted to the care of Texas, their lives become Dickensian in the scope of their tragedy. So a root question is not just about children or prisoners in Texas's care. It's about whether Texas, and I don't want to exclude other states in this, but whether Texas simply doesn't care about human beings in its care. Whether children, adults, convicts, people awaiting trial, or whatever. This long-term indifference to human welfare seems to be in the institutional DNA of Texas. And I'm not necessarily pointing fingers at just Republicans, frankly. Andrew?
Well, absolutely. States don't care about the humans in their care. And it is institutional. I mean, capitalism drives people to exploit other people as much as possible while returning as little of what those people make to them as possible. I think the solution is a move away from capitalism. In the meantime, though, I actually have had trouble finding organizations trying to reform foster care by listening to the people who go through it. The organization Children's Rights is the only one I've seen significantly dedicated to reform, only one I've seen in my research. But even they rely on local child advocates rather than children themselves. I think youth-run, youth-led organizations like the National Youth Rights Association, there's links to both of these organizations' websites on the blog post, should make connections with the people currently and formerly in these systems to show governments what they want to see changed. Because, in my opinion, the people who have been through these systems are the experts.
I will take exception with your claiming that capitalism is responsible for this. I think this is a human problem. Wards of the state, prisoners, whether it's a capitalist system, a socialist system, a fascist system, a communist system, I don't know of many, if any, countries that have ever treated such people well. Whether it's a matter of human greed, where they skim profits off the top, or whether it's indifference, or whether it's casual cruelty, it doesn't seem like this is a matter of the economic or political system. This is, seems to be very much a human nature issue. So that's my opinion on it. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2. We air Wednesdays at 11 a.m., and you can also hear the show at kpft.org. You can podcast it. You can go to archive.kpft.org. KPFT is Houston's community station, which means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage. I swear it's new. And hit the donate button. Pick your favorite show, which is hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you could get a lovely thank you gift, my Vanna White thing. You can also donate by texting the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. You can also spread the word, because that helps us too, and it's free, and any cash donations, by the way, are tax deductible. Okay, our next story, and this was also brought to my attention by Andrew. This is from Vice.com. The headline, it's almost comical. Starbucks is blatantly trying to crush its union. Starbucks executives have swarmed Buffalo, New York stores, pulling aside workers to chat one-on-one during their breaks at peak hours and at night. Whoever said your vote doesn't count, right? Since three stores, it's almost like retail politics in Iowa. Since three stores filed for a union election in August and announced the formation of Starbucks Workers United, management at the coffee chain has been holding group and one-on-one meetings with workers, discouraging employees from speaking to reporters and posting on social media, and sending upper management into stores to monitor workers and to help make lattes, according to documents obtained by Motherboard. I will just say my experience when management comes into a store to show how, you know, they're just folks, I probably wouldn't want one of those lattes. While Starbucks has tried to distinguish itself as a progressive employer, by the way, the guy who founded Starbucks is from my old neighborhood, Canarsie, went to my high school. While Starbucks has tried to distinguish itself as progressive as a progressive employer for decades by raising wages, offering health care benefits and other perks, many of its tactics in Buffalo are standard practices used by anti-union employers to dissuade employees from engaging in collective action and unionizing. These practices include trying to make improvements and pander to workers in the lead-up to a union election. In recent weeks, executives from Seattle and regional managers have swarmed local stores. Swarming, that's a vision. Pulling aside workers to chat one-on-one. Can you imagine an executive swarm? What must that sound like? Pulling aside workers to chat one-on-one during their breaks, at peak hours, at night, and even on Labor Day weekend, helping baristas make coffee, clean up, and take out the trash. Said Jazz Brissack, a barista from one of the Buffalo stores that filed for a union election, they're rolling up expensive suits to wash dishes and do trash runs. It's almost comical. Roseanne Williams, the president of Starbucks North America, which has more than 8,000 coffee shops, also has been spending long hours in Buffalo stores talking to workers, sitting in the parking lot, and handing out $10 gift cards to customers, according to workers. Motherboard, which is to say motherboard.com, spoke to workers in three separate stores who said they feel surveilled, distracted, and intimidated by Williams's sudden presence in their stores. A spokesperson for Starbucks noted that Williams makes stops at Starbucks around the country each week to talk to workers. This week, Starbucks announced that unionizing stores will hold mandatory meetings known as captive audience meetings that are regularly used by employers to dissuade and intimidate workers from unionizing by presenting anti-union rhetoric as fact. This is a highlight point. These meetings are also used as an opportunity for employers to gauge which workers are pro-union, a tactic used by many anti-union employers across the country, such as Amazon, Whole Foods, and Walmart. I'll also point out it's a tactic used by many repressive governments who become more lenient and invite more open discussion, more press freedom, then discover the people that want those things and crack down on them. So it's sort of an old tactic in both business and politics. At one of these sessions, the North America President Williams told workers, quote, "We don't believe our partners need unions to speak on their behalf," Motherboard confirmed. In response to employee concerns, management has suddenly replaced an oven that had been broken, fixed carpets, and sent an exterminator into a store to remove a beehive where workers had been getting stung regularly for months. Despite this sudden interest in improving working conditions for their workers in Buffalo, members of Starbucks Workers United say executives, including Williams, have refused to sign a set of fair election principles that the workers proposed, which would include allowing the union to hold meetings in response to those the company holds, refraining from bribing or threatening workers to gain their support, and agreeing to no negative repercussions in response to a successful union election, or an unsuccessful one, I might add. In an hour-long one-on-one session with Williams, Michael Sanabria, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, a Starbucks employee at one of the unionizing stores in Buffalo, said Williams told him, quote, "The best way for the company to listen to the partners is not have something come between us." Well, you know, marriage counselors come between couples, and sometimes that's actually helpful. Starbucks Workers United filed for an election next week, but have not yet received approval from the National Labor Relations Board. A hearing has been scheduled for September 20th. Well, I've kind of put in a few little quips here and there, so I'll let Andrew take it, and then we'll see where I go.
Well, I've heard that Starbucks has long been a unionizing white whale, and many unions have tried before, so I'm excited that things are moving here. It will be a long fight, though. Starbucks' actions are, in my opinion, very clearly trying to discourage unionization and are very clearly illegal, but I don't expect the NLRB to step in. As for Starbucks' arguments, competent and democratically run unions don't come between a company and its workers. They put workers on the same footing as the company. When people work together on the same terms, they work harder and aren't bogged down by resentment and internal conflict. Workers and the company benefit in the end, but many companies choose power over workers rather than increased prosperity. And that's why unionizing is so often a hard fight.
You know, I try not to have rose-colored glasses about this. Businesses are certainly not perfect. Business owners are not perfect. Unions are not perfect. Sure. Union leaders are not perfect. Government is not perfect. But we need all three of those things. And they all need to be, in my opinion, what I call the socioeconomic triad. I've mentioned this before, that basically I think that you need these three parts of society to be in dynamic tension. It's kind of like the legal system, where the legal system is an adversarial system. Each side does their best to present their side of the case. And that's why we need to have these three parts of our society in dynamic tension. You have good union leaders and corrupt union leaders, and you have business people that, you know, they remember where they came from, and others that are borderline psychopaths. And, you know, I mean, you've got this entire mix. I understand a business not wanting a union. I understand a union wanting and needing to be able to confront a business on equal terms, meaning one-on-one. But I think that even allowing for those things, some of the actions that Starbucks is taking here, as well as other companies that were mentioned in the article, just reprehensible as well as illegal. And, you know,
yeah, I mean,
Walter Cronkite used to say, that's the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, your mention of the socioeconomic triad. If you remember, if you've ever seen a scene in a movie where one of the main characters is
now, we're
like,
not talking about Alien, are we?
No, we're not talking about Alien. I still haven't seen that. But, you know, there's a common trope, I think, where a character is pushing their arms and legs against a wall or against all like walls on all sides of them to try and stop themselves from falling into some sort of pit or something like that. And it's the tension in their muscles keeping them held up. So if you want to keep the current society that we have held up, yes, you need this kind of tension to, you know, to keep yourself lifted off the ground. Of course, not everybody wants this society to continue the way it is, and that's a legitimate view. But if you do want it that way, you have to keep it that way.
I've come up, while you were talking, with a monster movie science fiction analogy for this.
Oh, boy.
The 1950s version of The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene toward the end where this very dedicated scientist who, you know, comes off as kind of a jerk, but obviously it turns out really believes in what he's doing and what he's been saying. Mm-hmm. And he goes up to The Thing. And of course, he's a little agitated, which may not have helped. And he's saying, please, we just want to understand you. We just want to talk to you. We just want to learn from you. And The Thing just swats him aside and kills uh-huh. him with a blow. Now, you could argue that the scientist is labor and The Thing is big business. Or you could argue it's the other way around. But I think it's an interesting metaphor for the problem.
Hmm.
You've seen The Thing?
I have not, but I know it. I know it well enough. I've seen snippets. I think I saw the 70s version.
Yeah, which is a great movie, but it's not a 1950s movie.
Big brawny guy who was like a professional wrestler. Was it Roddy Piper?
I don't know who The Thing was in the 70s or early 80s movie. I know that in the 50s movie, it was James Arness who went on to play Marshall Dillon in Gunsmoke.
Okay, because I think in the 70s movie, like,
you don't
the guy
even
I'm
seem
thinking
impressed
of,
by that. You need a serious popular culture education here.
I mean, you know, it's I just there's a lot of old stuff I haven't seen, but there's a lot of old stuff I have seen. So, you know, I'm working my way through it anyway.
We need a more targeted approach. We're going to have to consult on this. I understand nobody can watch everything, which is why I hate even spoiler warnings from 50-year-old movies, because mm-hmm. nobody can watch everything made in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we need a more targeted approach for you, Andrew. I think we're going to have to work on this as a project.
Okay, great. I'm going to have a classic film summer school or whatever. Okay.
Yes,
great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Next is actually an opinion piece from the Arizona Republic, azcentral.com, entitled California Recall Lesson. Republicans believe in elections only when they win. The California recall offers more proof that Republicans will accept elections as legit only if they win. That's a sure way to destroy democracy. The article or the opinion piece goes on. Republicans, like totalitarians, believe in elections, but only if they always win. New case in point, California, where voters on Tuesday, and we now know, did in fact decide to keep Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom as governor in a recall election. Cue Larry Elder, the leading Republican to replace him, who started dropping unsubstantiated claims that the election was rigged against him. Now, I was watching Rachel on Monday night, and she pointed out that Elder's campaign website made claims of election fraud before a single ballot had officially been counted. The polls had not yet closed, and he was already claiming election fraud. Or maybe there's something worse going on. Maybe Elder had the new mail-in count before the polls closed, while it was still a tightly guarded secret. That would imply maybe a mole in the California Secretary of State's office. So, I mean, I hate to say it, I'm at a point in my life, and the Republican Party is at a point in its life where I don't know that I would put much past them. But I want to be fair here. It isn't only many Republicans who have this problem that if they win, it's legit, and if they lose, it's rigged. One of my persistent observations during the Democratic presidential primaries of both 2016 and 2020, and I'm not going to generalize to everybody, but there were a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who only accepted primary results when Bernie won, and when Bernie lost, they claimed the vote was rigged by the Democratic establishment. I never met a Bernie supporter who felt that was essentially kind of a Trumpian way to feel. But, you know, this is a problem among some people on the left. It's a problem among a lot of people on the right. It's a problem in America right now. Andrew?
Well, first off, I want to say there is another possibility for Larry Elder's claims of election fraud, because in elections, parties will often sort of have like hotlines where you can report things that you felt, you know, might be voter intimidation, or if you weren't treated fairly at the polls, or this sort of thing. So,
but he might have won. He might have won.
He might have, but it's possible that his campaign received some calls or some reports of something like that from voters who were sympathetic and felt like they had been intimidated or otherwise treated unfairly. And so on that basis, they said something fishy's going on here. I'm not saying they're right, but I'm saying it's another possible explanation. So
unless it's something egregious, at least in this country up until the last few years, it's been typical to wait until you either win or lose before claiming that there was fraud.
Sure. Sure.
Because it could be really embarrassing to claim fraud and win.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I get that. And that still makes it suspicious, because it sort of implies that they expected to lose almost. But anyway, the other thing I was going to say first before I thought of that is I don't believe it's fair to compare Trump's claims of election fraud and Bernie supporters' claims of election fraud for two reasons. One, Bernie never agreed with the claims and certainly was not responsible for them like Trump was. And two, a party primary is not administered in the same way or with the same oversight as a general election. So the claims are fundamentally different. Besides, no claim of election fraud can be dismissed out of hand as long as the U.S. uses electronic voting. All claims deserve investigation. Trump's claims were properly investigated and found to have no merit. Bernie supporters' claims, as far as I know, were not.
Well, anyway, there were some court cases, and you know, there were some heads that rolled, and there were some rulings. But I mean, it was so consistent. It just seemed that every time he lost, there was just this raft of supporters who would claim that it was fraudulent, and they were only happy when he, I mean, I'm going to say only happy, of course, when he won. But that was the only time they felt an election was legitimate, whereas you didn't hear, let's say, Hillary supporters, or you didn't hear Biden supporters going out constantly claiming that any victories that Bernie had were rigged. I mean, it was a very one-sided kind of thing.
I mean, I could sort of make a snarky response. In fact, yeah, no, you know, I think I'm going
to.
There,
I do it all the time.
The Hillary and Biden camps didn't retaliate with claims of fraud when Bernie won, because their strategy from the start was to say he's not supposed to be here. He's not qualified to be here. If you vote for him, you're betraying us, or you're betraying the Democratic Party, you're betraying democracy, blah, 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 blah.
They were campaigning as opposed to... If I win, it's legit, and if I lose, it's fraudulent.
But they were campaigning not on I'm the better candidate, but on I have a right to your vote, and you do not have a right to vote for anyone else.
No, that was an inference. That was never something they campaigned on. They campaigned on their virtues, and of course they campaigned against what they saw as their opponent's weaknesses. But they never said, and I am entitled to your vote. Now, you can infer that. People can infer anything from anything. But, you know, let's stick to the facts. That was never a claim they made. But the haters inferred it, just like the haters infer things about Bernie.
Well, we could go back and forth on this, I think.
Yes, we could. And we need to move on. We have a break to do.
Well, hang on. I saw a couple of weeks ago that Republicans only called this recall because they believe they'd benefit from the lowered victory requirements for the replacement election. If they had any integrity, they would have simply waited a year for the regular election.
True. And I will also point out that in a previous show, I did a little research, and of 19 recall elections in 2020, 16 of them were called by Republicans against Democrats. So what we have here is a constant attempt to implement what amount to legal coups d'etat. Or coup d'etats. I'm not sure which is the plural there.
Coups d'etat, I think.
Well, it should be like attorneys general, but I've never heard coups d'etat, whereas I've heard coup d'etats. So I don't know. We need a French speaker. Okay. And I'm a very poor Spanish speaker. All right. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2. We air Wednesdays at 11 a.m., and you can hear us live online, kpft.org, podcast us, or listen to previously aired shows at archive.kpft.org. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on the post for a show any given week, or you can search for prior shows with keywords, dates, or whatever. We're also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. We have a Facebook page, Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and you can look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, plus Andrew has his things.
I do, too. I indeed do. That was, a little awkward. You can find me on Twitter.
Live, recorded live, as they say.
You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and on Tumblr, spelled the same, at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Our next story is from Gizmodo.com. Anonymous claims to have stolen huge trove of data from Epic, the right-wing's favorite web host. The controversial domain registrar, which has been known to host Nazis and other unfortunate groups, is the way it reads, apparently just had all of its data boosted. Members of the hacktivist collective Anonymous claim to have hacked web registration company Epic, allegedly stealing a decade's worth of data, including reams of information about its clients and their domains. Epic is controversial, having been known to host a variety of right-wing clients, including ones that previous web hosting providers like GoDaddy have dropped for various reasons. Its users have included conservative social. Conservative is so overused in this context. I'm going to insert the phrase extreme right-wing social media networks such as Parler and Gab, as well as conspiracy theory-laden YouTube wannabe BitChute, never heard of it, and former President Trump fan site, God, I hate when I do those words consecutively, The Donald. The company recently hosted ProLifeWhistleblower.com, the website designed to help people snitch on Texas residents who want abortions, but later forcibly were removed the tip-collecting platform after determining that it had violated Epic's terms by non-consensually collecting third-party information. And I think that violating Epic's terms sounds like an epic challenge. This data set is all that's needed to trace actual ownership and management of the fascist side of the internet that has eluded researchers, activists, and, well, just about everybody, the anonymous release claims. Gizmodo has downloaded copies of the Epic data and will be assessing its content. In my opinion, you know, it's hard not to feel a little gleeful, but, you know, remember, it's all about whose ox is gored. At the top of the show, we talked about Apple putting out an emergency security patch for an exploit they originally didn't know was even possible. All of us are at risk of becoming civilian casualties in a data war that most of us are ill-equipped to fight. Andrew?
Well, I, for one, am overjoyed by this hack. Fascism is evil and must be opposed by any and all effective means possible. Now, for legal reasons, I
but
must clarify.
But what about your ox is gored?
For legal reasons, I must clarify that I am not advocating for any illegal activity and that my opinions are my own. That's always a good one to throw in there. I take your point, though, that we are all at risk of having our data exposed. But I find that risk reasonable if it means fighting fascism. The best defense we have is good habits. Review your accounts regularly. Delete old ones. Enable two-factor authentication. Keep sensitive data local and encrypted. That sort of thing. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, there's a link on the blog post on thinkwingradio.com, has more resources on data security.
Do I have that link on there? Is that in the article? I don't remember.
It will be. That. It will be.
Ah, okay. Gotcha. What that means is he's going to be inserting it in his comments, and I'll be inserting his comments into the web post, and that's how we'll do that. Okay. For our last story from spacenews.com, NASA astronaut to stay on ISS for nearly a year. NASA confirmed September 14th that one of its astronauts, Mark VandeHei, will remain on the International Space Station until next March, setting an American spaceflight duration record in the process. The extended stay may give VandeHei a second chance to perform a spacewalk. He was scheduled to accompany Aki Hoshide on a spacewalk last month to install equipment needed for future solar panel upgrades. However, NASA postponed it because of what it called a minor medical issue involving VandeHei. The agency didn't elaborate, but VandeHei later tweeted that he had a pinched nerve in his neck. Now, this is how life experience affects your interpretation of stories. I suffer from chronic back pain. It gets better or worse, but it never goes away entirely. So astronaut VandeHei had to cancel a spacewalk because of a pinched nerve in his neck. Ow, I can identify with that. I'm not sure that this pinched nerve problem ever goes away in the absence of serious therapy or even surgery. Now, you know how various rides and exercises caution you against participating if you have back problems? Imagine having to do an atmospheric reentry with the equivalent of a 5 mile per hour impact on landing and having a pinched nerve in your neck. The full story gives a very complicated reason for why VandeHei is getting another 6 months on the ISS. But I can't help but wonder if part of the reason that he was called it is that they're trying to figure out how to get him back safely with that pinched nerve in his neck. I have a sneaking suspicion, and I wish not, but don't be shocked if the next resupply mission or the one after that brings up a special neck brace for his return that has to be custom made for the return in a space capsule. I can't even imagine how painful that would be if this was not a transient thing. Andrew?
Well, I'm going to start off in a little bit of a weird direction, but I promise I'll bring it back around. I'm really comforted by the idea that no matter what kind of stuff is going on Earth, space is still out there. I think about that anytime I enjoy apocalypse fiction. All the stars and planets we've studied will still be out there doing their thing. And in this case, it seems the same is true, no matter what happens in low Earth orbit. I like that we can have these funny, albeit painful, human moments, even in space, an environment we were never evolved to survive in. In the same way that I'm comforted by the universe being larger than us, I'm comforted by how we can still have our own little concerns in that universe.
I hope that we have a space-born civilization someday, but I keep thinking of the old saying, everywhere you go, there you are.
Yep.
Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, and phone buddy is Andrew Ferguson. We hope you've enjoyed the show and look forward to speaking to you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving.
Hey, y'all, this is Susan, your host of Border Radio on Houston's community station, KPFT. Border Radio is on the move. Join us on our new day and time, Saturday evenings from 6 to 8, right after Deadbeat. We'll feature some of your favorite independent artists and songs from new artists on the rise. We'll spotlight concerts for the week to come, from in-person shows in our area to live-stream events you can enjoy right from home. And Border Radio will keep bringing you the great on-air interviews you've come to expect from KPFT. Mark your calendar for Border Radio, Saturday nights from 6 to 8 on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, and kpft.org.
Good afternoon, Houston. This is your forecast for KPFT. For the remainder of the afternoon, sunny with a high near 91. For your Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 73. And for your Sunday, high percent chances of showers and thunderstorms. So stay dry this Sunday, and I hope you're off to a great weekend. This is your forecast for KPFT. Have a great afternoon, Houston.